53 degrees Kenosha, 52 right now in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be following a fascinating and also deeply disturbing story, crime story as a matter of fact, courtesy of a really interesting new book called Among the Bros, a fraternity crime story. This is the story of what unfolded over the course of several years on the campus of the College of Charleston, in which something that maybe at a glance might have seemed like a rather modest-scaled fraternity drug ring turned out to be something far more vast and complicated and troubling. And the closer my morning show guest, Max Marshall, looked at this story, the more intriguing and troubling it became. And he ended up spending a great deal of time exploring, first of all, in just sort of overall the life of Greek organizations on college campuses, and particularly what can unfold if a fraternity is, in a sense, allowed to run amok and with local law enforcement not doing their job. It's a really interesting story and told very well in this new book. Max Marshall is a journalist and a writer, and his work has appeared in GQ, Sports Illustrated, the New York Times, and this book, again, is titled Among the Bros, a Fraternity Crime Story, published by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins. Max Marshall, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
This was a really interesting book for me to read, in part because this is a world that I directly know absolutely nothing about. I mean, it is so far removed from who I was as a college student, and even today as my full-time job is as a college professor. And still, I mean, this is just not anything that is part of my experience, or as far as I know, not really a part of the lives of any of the college students with which I regularly work and interact. But there is, of course, this whole world, and you at one point were, in a sense, a part of it. Not a part of this drug ring, of course, or anything quite that nefarious. But one of the things you mentioned more than once in the book is that, in a sense, these are your people you are writing about, and that also helped you, in a sense, gain access and close relationships with some of the people you talked about to help unravel this story. Let's start with that sort of personal aspect of all this for you.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, it is an incredibly sealed-off bubble, sort of this gilded bubble. Almost by design, these fraternal organizations kind of create a separate campus for often kids from pretty elite backgrounds. And if you aren't in these, if you're not on the guest list for the parties, or you know, getting to see what's going on in the basement, you might not know what's happening at all. That having been said, even if you're not directly interacting with people from Greek life, you're sort of living in their world. You know, there's a statistic that a lot of fraternities put out in their sort of admissions pamphlets about, you know, just how many senators, CEOs, Supreme Court justices, presidents, something like all but four presidents since the mid-1800s have been fraternity men. And so even if, you know, you're not a member of a fraternity, even if you're not hanging out with fraternity people, or even if you, like you, are, you know, teaching on a college campus and you're not seeing it up front, you're still sort of living in the fraternity world. But yeah, you're absolutely right. This is the world that I come from. I grew up in Dallas, Texas, kind of in that bubble. My mom was an sorority. My dad founded the SAE chapter at his college. Almost everyone I was friends with in high school went on to join a fraternity. And then, yeah, I joined one myself. And I think that absolutely, I don't think I would have been able to report this story if I didn't have those sort of credentials. I think without that, very few people would have met me at bars or restaurants or talked to me on the phone to kind of tell me how this drug ring worked, or even beyond that, you know, just their hazing stories, or really anything. These are secrets to outsiders. And then once you're inside the bubble, everyone loves to tell the stories. So you kind of have to get inside the bubble before people start opening up.
I want to just mention parenthetically, I probably shouldn't waste the time doing this, but nevertheless, I guess if nothing else, it kind of reveals my own, let's call them prejudicial thoughts about people who belong to fraternities. And that's the fact that when I read your biography and noticed that you graduated summa cum laude from Columbia University, I mean, I my jaw dropped. I mean, literally, my jaw dropped, because in my mind, it's inconceivable that somebody who is involved in, I mean, of course, there are certain fraternities that are really all about academic excellence, but from what you tell us in the book, you know, that's not what your life in a fraternity was about. And yet...
Oh, no. It's about parties.
Right.
Yeah, completely.
And so, it's just, again, to me, kind of inconceivable that somebody could have that as a very important central part of their college or university experience, and yet graduate summa cum laude. I mean, it would never even occur to me that such a thing could be possible.
That's hilarious. But yeah, I mean, I definitely felt like I had one foot in, one foot out. I had incredibly conflicting feelings about the sort of fraternity world, my fraternity experience. By senior year, I stopped paying dues. That having said, you know, so many of my close friends from college and a lot of the first people to read this book were people I was in the fraternity with. But I do think it was the thing that got me reporting this story to begin with was the amount of Xanax I saw flying around fraternity parties as both an anxiety drug and more so as a party drug. And that's what led me down this whole rabbit hole. So yeah, it really all did begin with that sort of first person experience in the fraternities. And then, you know, in some ways really caring about the friends I saw who were dropping out of school because of Xanax dependencies or starting to deal Xanax even kind of as we got closer to graduation.
So tell us about your initial exposure to this specific story, central to which is a student by the name of Mikey Schmidt, but others were involved in what turned out to be a vast drug ring. How did you first even become aware of this, and what about the story at the outset intrigued you enough to want to investigate it further?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I saw so much Xanax in college, I didn't expect in college for Xanax of all things to be sort of the it party drug. You know, it's designed for panic attacks and seizures. If you mix it with four or five Keystone Lights, you black out. Your mind stops taking in memories, basically. And I was seeing a lot of some people call it barring out. I was seeing so much of it that when I became an investigative journalist after school, I wondered, you know, is there a way to tell this story as kind of an investigative crime story? Because I was really curious where are these drugs coming from, because they weren't coming from Pfizer. They were fake Xanax pills that somebody was making in pill presses. So, and I realized a lot of this was kind of going through the fraternity scene. So I sat down and I Googled Xanax bust fraternity. And the first result was this article in the Charleston Post and Courier about a group of KAs, SAEs, and then a few of their friends who got caught with a pound and a half of cocaine, a dozen pounds of weed, some Molly, some LSD, a grenade launcher, some assault rifles. They had their cars confiscated. And it also said they had been caught with 44,000 Xanax pills. And I thought that was a lot of pills. But I started doing some research and started developing sources. And one source sort of let it slip that, in fact, the police had confiscated a few million Xanax pills and never publicized that fact. And, of course, from there, the story really fractaled out of control. You know, I found a murder of a student, you know, many fraternity members and alumni who were dying of overdoses, and eventually the fact that almost everyone in this drug ring, except for Mikey Schmidt, who you mentioned, and a few others, but most of the people involved never got any jail time. And to this day, it still hasn't been publicized, although I guess the book comes out today. So it is now being publicized that they actually found millions of pills, which makes it, by many metrics, the largest college drug ring ever discovered.
And can you explain that discrepancy between what was told to the public and what, in fact, was the scope of this? What was the point of not being fully transparent about the scale of this operation?
I mean, I do think part of it is many of the boys in the drug ring cooperated with the police, and so that was the sort of terms of the cooperation agreement. But I do think on a broader level, there is a sense of a, you know, for lack of a better phrase, a good old boy system. These guys were able to hire the best defense lawyers in South Carolina, and they got the sort of deals that most people arrested with drugs could ever dream of. And that proved true kind of time and time again. This drug network involved dozens and dozens of boys. And I say boys, I mean, they were, for the most part, between the ages of, say, 18 and 23. But really only two have done substantial jail time, and then two others did, you know, about a year or two. But most of them got away with suspended sentences or probation or no charges at all.
We're speaking with Max Marshall, and we're talking about his book, Among the Bros, A Fraternity Crime Story. I don't think we should go any further without giving you a chance to talk about that main title, Among the Bros, and that phrase. Again, for some of us for whom this is a very alien world, we might not be acquainted with that turn of phrase.
Sure. So, I mean, it's a playoff. One of my favorite books, Bill Buford's Among the Thugs, which is an exploration into soccer hooligan culture in the 80s. But this is about bros, which was, especially at the time of this book, taking place from 2012 to 2016, what both guys and fraternities and certainly the outside world called fraternity members. And not just fraternity members, they're, you know, lax bros and tech bros, and in the realms of politics, it became a thing, you know, the Bernie bro, and the word has taken on so many meanings to the point where I think it's sort of vaporized, and, you know, I'm not even sure what it means anymore. But at the time, it described a very specific kind of guy. Keg stands, polos, you know, lacrosse, darties, which is day parties. And then maybe by the end of college, it became subsumed in more of an identity discourse and meant someone who had the cross-sectional identity of being white, wealthy, and male, and hanging out with other guys who looked like him. And so even that turn, I think, was kind of fascinating to watch in real time. Because you're seeing a group of guys who are used to being kind of the heroes of the story kind of become the jesters of the story and then eventually become the villains of the story. And that was a lot of whiplash.
Speaking of whiplash, one of the things you describe in your book is the rather drastic shift in attitude or approach when it came to certain fraternities who once upon a time saw themselves in a certain way, and then found that kind of drastically shifted in terms of how they wanted to be viewed, and what they most wanted to do. And it sounds like thanks to some films, that's part of what kind of helped shift the universe of fraternities a bit.
Absolutely. So, I mean, as I was saying before, fraternities kind of from the offset set themselves up as a sort of separate campus for the elite, for lack of a better word. You know, in the 1800s, the first fraternity sort of formed at elite Northeastern schools when schools started letting in ministerial students. So you had kind of students from middle-class backgrounds showing up to be ministers. And so the guys from, you know, the Greenwich Connecticuts of the day said, okay, well, we need to start our own club to keep these sort of ministerial students out. And so by the mid-20th century, the sort of stereotypical frat guy was sort of this Richie Rich image of khakis and crooning and name tags at parties and lounge piano and sort of, you know, the sort of Bushwood country club set. And this didn't fare well in the 60s. You know, the sort of countercultural campus movement saw these guys as sort of boring snoots who, you know, were too square to smoke weed and just like basically were living this sort of like country club life in the middle of what was an exciting kind of party time for the cooler kids. And in the 60s, fraternity membership hit an all-time low. Still to this day, it's its historic low. And people started kind of saying, this is the end of fraternities. And then the movie Animal House came out and was this really brilliant rebrand of fraternities, because you did have the snooty fraternity kind of on one side, but then you had John Belushi's fraternity on the other, which, you know, was hitting golf balls in the ROTC drills and smoking weed and breaking the rules and, you know, driving their parade float to wreck the dean's spot on the bleachers. And basically this idea of, we are the counterculture too. We smoke weed, we break rules, we're wild. But at the same time, we're still the kind of guys who like to golf, and we still are the kind of guys who, you know, like wear sweaters. And it was an incredibly brilliant rebrand. And then by the 1980s, fraternity membership hit a high again. And so I think, yeah, there's this sort of turn from, we're the boring sort of rich guys to we're the bad boy rich guys. And that was an incredibly effective rebrand.
Mm. Well, and of course, the fact that we're talking then about, as you called it, kind of its own separate bubble or biosphere, this separate campus in a sense, means that it's also in a sense a perfect breeding ground for misconduct, shall we say, on a sort of a global stage. I mean, it's like a petri dish for misbehavior, except that we're talking about misbehavior at a really shockingly serious level.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in some ways, this book is about the consequences of a life without consequences. If you can hit your head into a tree without getting a concussion, you'll just continue to bang your head into a tree because it's kind of exciting. And I think on a broader level, you see, you know, if you can drive drunk, but the family lawyer will bail you out, or if you can have this insane, you know, party and burn things down, which happens in the book, and the alumni will sort of step in and pay for the damages, or, you know, even, and then you get said, more serious accusations like, you know, drug rings or sexual assault, but you know there's this sort of scaffolding around you that'll protect you. It's hard to learn to not do things. And if anything, there's almost a sign of power or prestige of like, look what I can get away with. And I think I certainly saw that play out in the book, and I think you certainly can see it play out on a more macro level, like you said.
Let's be sure to spend a little time talking about the main character in your book, whose photograph is on the cover. I assume this is Mikey Schmidt, who is staring at us from the cover of your book. He is an interesting young man, and his life of crime, in a sense, does not begin with drug dealing. Explain kind of the pathway in which he found himself, first of all, into this specific fraternity, and then ultimately into this life of crime for which now he is serving time in jail.
Absolutely. So, I mean, the first thing to say is that face on the cover is actually the founder of Sigma Nu from the 1860s.
You know, I wondered. It's an interesting photograph because the face is just sepia tone, but then whoever this is appears to be wearing kind of a bright pink shirt, and I kind of wondered if there was a possibility that this was some kind of composite. So, go ahead.
It is, and it's funny, but it shows you how little the haircuts have changed over 150 years.
Yeah.
That was definitely by design to kind of show what's changed and what hasn't changed, I suppose. But all that's to say is Mikey, he did have very similar hair to the guy on the cover. Mikey's from the Atlanta suburbs. He showed up to the College of Charleston after having a 7-inch growth spurt his senior year. So up until senior year, his voice hadn't changed yet, and he was 5'0". And I think because of that developed this sort of preternatural confidence and a swagger almost. And he arrived at the College of Charleston already with a decently booming weed business, and he was selling fake IDs, which in the fraternity world is very important, especially at a school where that kind of revolves around going out to bars. You basically have to have a fake ID to be able to hang with Greek life. And so he got a bid into the Kappa Alpha Order, which is this sort of predominantly Southern fraternity. Their spiritual founder is Robert E. Lee. Most of the members are from the South. And he, within a year, dropped out of school. I think he was, mostly missing class. He was dealing and smoking weed, and I think only tried Xanax once at that point. But when he got home to Atlanta, he started working as a valet boy in at the Tongue and Groove, which is this sort of legendary nightclub in Atlanta, and started dropping drug samples in people's cup holders. And, by the end of the book, was part of this nationwide drug ring, bringing in cocaine from Mexico via Atlanta, bringing in Xanax pills from China via the dark web, bringing in marijuana from dozen plus sources, and running it through fraternities all around the South.
Hmm. We should maybe take just a moment to talk about Xanax and why it became and remains such an incredibly popular drug, and why so many young people have felt drawn to use it.
Yeah, so I mean, so as we were discussing a little bit earlier, it's an anti-anxiety tranquilizer, benzodiazepine. It was designed, and it's very effective for when you're having a panic attack. But people sort of realized that it's a very effective, what they call, sidecar drug. That's what the kids call it. What a scientist would call it is a polysubstance or polypharmacy drug, meaning it mixes very powerfully with other substances. So if you mix Xanax and cocaine, it might very effectively cut into the sort of paranoia you feel while you're on cocaine. If you mix it while you're smoking weed, it really sort of heightens or deepens the high you're feeling. Certainly that's the case with opiates, and most commonly it works synergistically with alcohol. So it works very similarly on the brain, sort of slowing the electrical current basically in your brain. And I think a lot of people in my parents' generation are surprised to know that for a lot of college kids, on some nights, blacking out is the goal. So, like, you would mix Xanax and, you know, whiskey, beer, or whatever it is, because you want to get blackout. And that's something I certainly saw. And then I think the other sort of strand in Xanax use that I saw everywhere was just really profound social anxiety. And Xanax, of course, is designed for anxiety. And a lot of kids describe it as sort of this opt-out pill. You're at these fraternity parties. There's sort of this social status Olympics going on. You're aware that you're in the fourth best fraternity. You're talking to someone from the second best sorority. Everyone is judging and ranking each other. Maybe you're used to more controlled interactions on your phone or whatever it is. But if you take enough Xanax and black out, or even don't black out, but you're just on Xanax, like, you're not thinking about those things. And, so I think that's really driving a lot of it.
Yeah. At one point, somebody describes the sensation of taking this as this, that you just feel like you've melted into whatever chair you're sitting in. And you go on to say, for people who experience some level of anxiety every day, it's hard to overemphasize how good that melting feels. So I really appreciate the time that you take to do this. That is, to kind of describe what is behind this widespread consumption of this drug that, of course, can lead to terrible, terrible trouble. One of the things you also explain is how your main character and his colleagues were able to do this. And one of the ways that they were able to do this is through something that most of us have only heard about and know little about, namely the dark web. Can you just say a quick word about that?
Sure. So, you know, up until fairly recently, if you wanted to deal drugs on a college campus, you had to tap into an established sort of criminal hierarchy, which would mean, you know, finding a cartel-connected source or a gang-connected source who's bringing drugs in through these, you know, very dangerous and complicated international sort of supply chains. But starting a little over a decade ago, there was the sort of invent of Tor, the dark web, which is basically, I don't know if you know what a virtual private network is, a VPN, but basically you can imagine it as sort of you're on Firefox or you're on Chrome or you're on Safari, but what Chrome or Safari is doing is it's scattering your location and sending it to servers all around the world. And so it's going to move much more slowly, but while it's scattering, it's basically impossible for the FBI, DEA, law enforcement, or really anyone to track where you actually are. And so with that sort of intense privacy comes this sort of these sort of spaces that are sort of Amazon for the black market. And that can mean anything from drugs to, smuggled rhino horn to, you know, there are always rumors that you can get a hit put out on someone via the dark web, although those are often sting operations. So, you know, take that with a grain of salt. But all that's to say is, instead of having to go up to the other side of the town and you know, try to find a cartel-linked source, you could stay in the safety of dorm Wi-Fi and have Xanax shipped from southern China or sort of wherever straight to your dorm. And guys would get it in DVD jackets. They would get it in just big boxes. And something a DEA agent told me is that at this point, the USPS is the largest drug trafficker in the world, just because the USPS is underfunded. And there's obviously the inventory that they're moving every day is basically impossible to sort of sort through. And so many of our illicit substances, just they travel through the mail. And without really much work, you can have these things just arrive at your dorm room, and then you can turn around and start dealing without ever risking, you know, gang, quote-unquote gang violence or, you know, whatever the parental nightmare of the day is. But the flip side of that danger is you have no idea what these drugs have been cut with. And certainly around 2018, that's when you started seeing pills cut with fentanyl and the sort of one pill kill phenomenon that's continuing today.
Right. Well, there's certainly plenty of death and personal destruction in this story. And of course, we ultimately read of how this all came crashing down. Real quick, last question. You ended up being able to speak with not everybody, but a number of participants in all this, including Mikey Schmidt himself. What was that like to speak with him? And how honest and open was he with you?
So yeah, I mean, the relation with Mikey was very sort of slow to unfurl. He was incarcerated by the time I really started reporting. He was sort of awaiting incarceration when I started. And I didn't know if I was going to be able to speak to him at all, but it turned out he had a cell phone smuggled to him in his cell. And we started talking very often. And, you know, it took a long time to gain his trust. But at this point, even after the reporting ended, we continue to FaceTime and, you know, I check in on how he's doing in there. But yeah, it became a very involved and ongoing conversation that is still ongoing.
The book, again, is Among the Bros, a fraternity crime story published by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins, and the author, Max Marshall. Max Marshall, thank you so much for crafting this fascinating and troubling book, and thank you for being my morning show guest. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program features an interview from the Morning Show archives, an interview recorded and initially broadcast back in 2010. Fans of horror movies are going to enjoy the next few minutes, I think. I'm going to be speaking with Don Sumner, who calls himself a horror movie freak and has been so from a very, very early age. And he has taken that lifelong interest in and affection for horror movies into the creation of a new book called Horror Movie Freak, in which we read his thoughtful essay on why we are drawn to horror movies as we are, and talking about some of the different categories of them, and then exploring some of the specifics. And there are all kinds of horror movies that you've never heard of and others that are great, great classics and among the finest and most important movies ever made. And we're going to explore all of that and more for the next few minutes with Don Sumner as we talk about his really interesting book, which is a publication of Krauss Publication. Don Sumner, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you very much. Happy Halloween.
Thank you. Explain to our listeners your where this love of horror movies began for you.
Well, I remember very distinctly as a child, back when cable television was different than it was today back then. There was maybe 10 or 12 films that would run over and over every month. And one of them was called Terror Train, a horror movie with Jamie Lee Curtis. And I begged my mom to let me watch it. I must have saw a preview or something. I really wanted to see it. She would not let me. So I snuck out in the middle of the night and really close to the TV, volume really low, and I watched it anyway. I got caught, though, because I had nightmares for weeks after that. But I think I've really spent the rest of my life searching again for that thrill that I had when I was a child.
So let's get a couple thoughts from you on the question posed in your opening essay, which is, what is it that draws us to horror movies, and is it the same thing that draws horror movie fans to these movies, or are different people drawn by different things?
Well, I don't think it's not necessarily going to be identical for everybody, but one of the common themes is, where else but a horror movie can you live through the worst case scenario, the biggest nightmare that you have, and effectively triumph over it, or at a minimum live through it and get up and walk out of the theater afterwards? Really, horror movies, it's very much like a child who wants to go on the roller coaster. He looks at it, he's intrigued by it, he's terrified by it. When the child finally gets to go on the roller coaster, maybe cries, maybe screams, but when he gets off of it, you lived. And so the first thing you want to do is get on it again and get on it again. And horror movies really, really allow for that for people, I think.
Hmm. One thing you mentioned in that opening essay is how there are different kinds of scares, and that there is the jolt scare versus other kinds of scary experiences that unfold with a very, very different sort of rhythm. I mean, where it is kind of a slowly mounting sense of dread. I wonder if you could just kind of talk a moment about that interesting contrast.
Well, and that is interesting. You know, Alfred Hitchcock once said that there is much more fear in the anticipation of an event than in the event itself. So it's one thing, the jolt scare, like you're talking about. I mean, that'll startle you, and that comes in lots of different ways. Maybe as simple as somebody creeping toward the cupboard, only to open the door and have a cat jump out. And everyone's going to jump at that, but it doesn't touch something that the anticipation of something terrible, or even worse, if it's something very particular for that individual that maybe they have a fear about. I think a lot of children, for example, when they're laying in bed, they see the closet door is open just a crack, and so all of a sudden the imagination is allowed to go wild. Is there a monster in there? Is there a crazy person in there? Are they going to jump out? Are they going to get me when I'm sleeping? And we can devise much more frightening scenarios in our own minds, because that's what's going to scare us, than if you just put it out there on the screen and show everybody. Then it's somebody else's vision.
Your book then goes on to explore all kinds of specific films over the years in various sorts of horror genres. One question I wanted to be sure to ask you is, in your mind, is every movie in this book a great movie or a great horror movie? Because I think one of the most intriguing things about this genre in particular is, as far as I think a lot of people in the general public are concerned, there is this incredible spread of quality between some movies that most film critics would call masterpieces and others that are not.
Yeah, well, absolutely. So all of the films, there's about 130 films that are discussed here in this book, and they're all really, really good. Whether or not they're all masterpieces may or may not be the case. The way it's broken down is into 15 different subgenres of horror, from ghost stories to monster movies, zombie movies, vampires, nature gone wild, aliens. And the thought was to make sure that there were really good examples, between 5 and 10, really good examples of each of those categories. So invariably what happens, if in the monster category, for example, there's 50 fantastic films to choose from, then there's going to be some that get left out if you're going to have between 5 and 10. And by the same token, there may be more masterpieces or generally accepted really, really great horror movies in the psychotics area, for example, or maybe in the ghost stories, and maybe less in the nature films, so there's going to be kind of a quality differential there, generally. But you know, it's really designed to be excellent examples of all the different flavors of horror.
One thing I really appreciate about the book is that there is a chapter all its own devoted to what you call reimaginings.
And
another section called modernizations. And it's, of course, two different things. But the idea of taking perhaps a very, very famous horror film and doing it again, or taking a familiar story and really transforming it. I wonder if you could just say a word about how successful these modernizations and reimaginings tend to be as far as you're concerned.
Well, and that's, you know, there's a lot of remakes. A lot of horror movie remakes are very, very popular right now. And what you're mentioning is some of the different kinds, just like horror isn't all the same under that same heading, every remake is not going to be the same either. So some of them can be very, very successful. I think, the reimagining concept, for example. So if you have a very well-known, very popular horror movie from the past, let's just take George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, for example. And if you're going to remake that, there's a couple ways you can do it. You can really just frame for frame effectively retell the story with new actors. That was done with Psycho. That was done with The Omen. Those generally are, there's not much point to those. So they don't tend to be very popular because there really wasn't any reason to do it. Whereas with Dawn of the Dead, 2004, that was redone. They took some of the same themes, but they made it their own. They added to the story. For example, zombies in Dawn of the Dead, the original, were just lumbering, flesh-feasting monsters. But in 2004, they thought, okay, so what if they can sprint after you? How's that going to change the fear factor? How's that going to change the equation? And so by mixing it up a little bit, the reimagining concept, you can, varying bits of success. Some of them are successful, some aren't. But adding something to the equation, having a reason to do the remake in the first place, I think is key to having it to have much value and really have much success.
Hmm. I was really glad that a couple of my own personal favorites are part of this book. And I wonder if you could just talk about a couple of these. One film that I saw recently for the very first time is called The Descent. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the scariest and most horrifying things I think I've ever seen. Could you just say a word about this particular film and why you include it here?
I think that's a fantastic film. They do so many things right in that. First of all, the characters, and there's four women, very athletic women, who get together periodically for extreme sports outings. And this particular one is surrounding a caving expedition. And first and foremost, they take some time to let us get to know these characters and care about what happens to them. It seems so basic that would be a key, but in so much horror today, it's almost like it's boring to the folks that are used to the internet, they're used to YouTube, very immediate gratification. Let's skip the boring stuff and get straight to the good stuff. But I think caring about the characters and being able to put yourself in their shoes is key. So it starts there, and then the whole first half of the movie, there's no monsters, there's nothing. They are caving in very close quarters. And it's very easy for your mind to start thinking of worst-case scenarios. Well, what would happen if you broke your leg so severely you couldn't climb back out? And then somebody does. And then what would happen if there is a cave-in and you're trapped in there? And, of course, all these worst-case scenarios are played out. I was squirming in my seat in the whole first half before there was any monsters at all. And then the final is, as far as really what's the worst thing, now you're trapped in there. Well, what if there's monsters in there? Well, there are. And so you have that, and then overlaid on all of that is the horror that human beings are capable of when put in really dire situations. And that is just a brilliant film that I think is absolutely one of the best horror films of the last several years.
No right. Doubt. I am glad that also present in your book are two films, 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later, which to me are amazingly effective because they are so believable, so plausible, which is something I would say is often not the case. I mean, I'm not particularly a horror movie fan, and I think one of the things that keeps me from getting emotionally invested in a lot of films is that they just don't seem like, this doesn't seem like something that I could ever imagine really happening. But right. 28 days later, 28 weeks later, I could imagine such a horrific thing occurring, and that, to me, is really, really scary.
Well, you know, and that's the very reason why there's so many different flavors of horror, and why for someone, I think, as a blanket statement to say I don't like horror movies is certainly possible. There are those that just don't like the discomfort, but I think in a lot of cases it's not that you don't like horror movies; it's just that you like a certain type, like you're speaking about. You have to be able to if you can relate to it. If you can really see that could happen, if it plays out a worst-case scenario that is plausible, as you said, in your own mind, that's what's going to be the most terrifying. So I agree. Those films are fantastic films.
Well, and it's interesting. When I think about some of the horror films that don't particularly interest me, I think about the kind of films that are particularly gory and kind of go over the top with the gore. And if I find myself with other people watching a movie like that so often what you're hearing is laughter from people watching it, and to me that's an entirely different experience, and it sort of feels like, you know, there, I mean, sometimes we laugh because we're nervous, but sometimes we just laugh because we're feeling other things besides genuine terror.
Well, and that's true of a lot of kinds of horror movies that I like. You see that a lot in the zombie movies, and I love zombie films. They're very, very gory, but I laugh like crazy when I'm watching them. It's part of what I like about them, is it's just so outlandish, so ridiculous that some of these things would ever actually happen. And that you know, I mean, funny. So you know, that's one of the reasons why I say horror movie freak, because not everyone's going to think that's funny. But it sure gets me rolling.
Right. I'll let you finish up by telling us about one of your favorite horror movies that you think maybe goes unappreciated or underappreciated that you would suggest we seek out.
Well, I have one in particular that I champion quite a bit from several years ago. It's called Darkness Falls. And the reason I champion that film is because the critics seem to pan it, and even the horror reviewers and critics don't like it. But the fact is, it's a kind of a ghost story. It's about the Tooth Fairy, and what happens really. I mean, because if you think about it, that whole concept of a Tooth Fairy coming into your bedroom when you're a child and reaching under your pillow and taking your tooth, that's made for horror. And you know, the concept here is that if you wake up and you see the Tooth Fairy, then she's not going to be happy with that, and she's going to seek you out. It really plays into so many of those childhood fears. The closet door open a crack, the monsters under the bed, fear of the dark, all of those, it just really rushed up a lot of those childhood fears and made them come alive on the screen. Very, very scary film. And I highly recommend that people check that one out, because I think a lot of people have similar experiences.
Very good. In the meantime, we can read about all kinds of other films. How many did you say are talked about in detail?
There's over 130 films that are discussed in horror movies.
Very good, including a silent classic we talked about on the morning show a few days ago, Nosferatu, and films like Alien and Aliens and Night of the Living Dead and Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Psycho, The Birds, all kinds of other films that are worth understanding. And the book is called Horror Movie Freak. And by the way, the book includes a DVD of the original Night of the Living Dead by George A. Romero. The author is Don Sumner. Don Sumner, I enjoyed this. Thank you very, very much.
I did too. Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the program. And on Friday, best-selling author Rick Beyer and his wonderful book called The Last Outlaws. Our weather forecast calls for sunny, mild conditions today with a high of 66 degrees, overnight low of 43. A few clouds tomorrow, but again a high of 63 degrees. And sunshine returns for the weekend along with cooler temperatures. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.